This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Since 1998, the drug Viagra has been prescribed to more than 23 million men worldwide to help them treat erectile dysfunction. And it's kind of that topic. You might expect it being a Friday that we're back to our old habits with Dr. George Lee, urologist.
So I guess the weekend before the Raya, we have no other experts in the panel. And then so I'm the only expert that's going to talk about it today. I guess that's the only difference. The other thing is that we don't have rain in Klang Valley today. It's actually quite a sunny afternoon.
A sunny, that's very quite warm unusual. Afternoon.
That's
yes.
A sunny, warm afternoon. And we don't have Mira. Where is Mira?
Mira is living it up in the City of Lights.
She is really?
In Paris.
Oh, wow.
Well, actually, I say living it up, but really she's attending a conference and hopefully she's going to come back with lots of interesting content for the bigger picture.
Wow, so absolutely.
You can look forward to that.
So it's a much bigger picture in the future, right?
Yes.
Okay. So let's talk about this big picture about the blue pill then.
Yes. There's been a new study that has linked, I wouldn't say linked, that's a strong word.
That's a strong word.
Associated use of the low blue pill with a higher risk of melanoma, which is a type of skin cancer. So today we're looking at whether or not you actually need to worry about this. You know, we're looking at the study and we're just analyzing why people get scared, I guess.
That's right. And why people do this? Why do people come up with study to put association between two things like that? And then indeed it scares people. In fact, this actually appeared in our local newspaper as a newspaper headline saying that the blue pill is associated with skin cancer. So something like that,
it's
obviously
a catchy headline.
It is a catchy headline. So what we want to do today is analyze, is that true, is that not? Because before you throw away all those precious pills that you have in your pocket, is this the right thing to do or not? And I really think it's an interesting subject to talk about. Because, I can draw a lot of parallel studies that has come up. And actually, the most famous one perhaps people can talk about was the MMR vaccines. If you actually start drawing that sort of a conclusion to say MMR vaccine is associated with autism, it can have detrimental effect. But for something like this, people will judge you. People will say, it's a sexual health drugs, and now Ganella.
Yeah, right? See, who asked you to do this?
It's all those years I decided not to take it. Now all the truth comes out. Is there any truth in that?
Exactly. As always, our phone lines are open. So if you'd like to let us know whether or not numbers like this scare you off medication, or if you just have any questions for Dr. George.
Not necessarily medications about like you have taken the blue pills before, that sort of things. But you can always say your friend has taken certain
yes,
pills.
And we also, all have lots of friends.
That's right. Or you can, I think most interestingly, perhaps you have an experience that you read something about like oral contraceptive pills associated with, deep vein thrombosis, breast cancer. Does that sort of figure worry you? And how much will you investigate to find out whether it worries you or not? Because the last time we actually talked, we were sitting here, Lynn, talking to you, was when we were having a lot of fun with Dr. Pramita, right?
Yes.
Talking about the HRT, replacement therapy.
Which is another therapy. I mean, all therapies, if there's one thing I've learned from this show over the years, it's that medication without side effects just don't exist.
Exactly.
Medicine without possible adverse reactions also don't exist in general.
So, right.
But I think that's something that a lot of people kind of struggle to get their head around. And when you read a number like, 21% people, have more of a chance of developing melanoma, you get scared. So our phone lines are open. That number is 03-77-109-000. You can also text 01-62-01-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Have you ever been frightened off medication
due to statistical analysis headlines like that?
Precisely. So let's look more closely at this exact headline then. What does it report?
Okay, right. So in fact, there are two separate studies. One study actually came out last year, and I'm really surprised that, it didn't grab so much headlines. In 2014, there's a Harvard, study actually look at a prospective cohort of 25,000 people. Basically, in year 2000, participants in this health profession follow-up studies looking at the usage of sildenafil, which is a little blue pill. The rationale behind this study is that if you imagine the blue pill opens up the vessel through a mechanism. And in this mechanism, what the researcher argues is that the mechanism will cause alterations in the receptors. And hence, it makes our skin more susceptible to cancer, such as malignant melanoma. So that was their hypothesis, to say, does that exist? So what they did was that looking at 25,000 American men and see what are their prescribing or what are their prescriptions habit. So essentially, have they actually cash in on the prescriptions such as sildenafil, vardenafil, tadalafil? These are the three drugs that are called PDE5 inhibitors that will cause obviously enhancement in sexual function and deal with issues of erectile dysfunction. The interesting thing they found out was that when you actually have got one prescription and then you have an increased chance of getting malignant melanoma, basal cell carcinoma, and also squamous cell carcinoma. All these three are cancers of the skin, and then one is the most kind of a serious one, perhaps is malignant melanoma. So, you know, out of there, they identify 142 malignant melanoma, 580 squamous cell carcinoma, and so 3,000 basal cell carcinoma. And from this study, they actually say that, okay, there is a risk association with that, but more study needs to be done. And in 2014, and then that was kind of left like that. And I'm quite amazed that nobody really picked that up until recently, in 2015, another researcher from Sweden came up with the idea to say, hang on a minute, this sort of thing is association. In fact, Forbes actually picked up to say it's not the blue pill that actually caused melanoma, but the blue pill lifestyle that caused melanoma. In the other study that was done in Sweden, they look at 20,000 people and look at it, because Sweden has got this kind of computerized system about your income, your household income, and also your traveling pattern, your spending pattern is all computerized. Quite extraordinary, really, isn't it? For you to have all those data accessible by the government, really. But it's good for healthcare that you look at it. And they realize that there's similar identifications of malignant melanoma associated with people who uses PDE5 inhibitors, such as the blue pills.
Well, you know, okay, so that kind of makes me wonder. When we look at things that are designed, pills that are designed to do very specific things, right? I mean, nobody takes the little blue pill, I think, for really any other purpose,
right,
other than,
okay, exactly,
you know, the thing that it's designed for. How often do we have drugs that could be causing random reactions, you know, in other parts of the body? Because it seems to me that if you were to look at the original study, never mind the blue pill lifestyle, that is a whole other issue. but if we were to look at the original study, I mean, who would think skin cancer has anything to do with something that opens,
you know,
up vessels?
Why would you do that? I mean, you know, most people would think that the blue pill and you associate with any sexual organ cancer, for example.
Precisely, yeah.
You know, you say if you take the blue pill, you have prostate cancer. Probably with a bit of stretching of imagination, you can kind of like trying to work out that link. I mean, but who would think about that? But so the researcher argued that this is because the mechanism that drug works and then may predispose you to skin cancer, which is really quite weird.
But there's no causation, right? I mean, there's no real cause and effect.
And well, in fact, there's none. Because this is essentially saying, let's say, you know, what the argument of the second researchers was saying, that let's say you have a group of people who can afford the blue pill. In Sweden, it's about $50 per pill, and those are more affluent family. Perhaps they're more affluent enough to actually go travel to countries that have plenty of sun. They're more affluent enough trying to look good in under the sun, and they're more affluent enough, perhaps, you know, to stereotype them, perhaps, you know, more blue eye, fair skinned person who are more likely to get skin cancer. In fact, that was the argument that is the Viagra lifestyle rather than the actual drug itself causing skin cancer.
Is there an associated lifestyle?
Well, this was the Swedish study was quite specific. They actually look at these group of men. What did they do? Have they more disposable incomes? What are their traveling pattern? And they draw that conclusion. conclusion to say that it is the more affluent people who actually have got more risk of predisposed risk of this. In fact, the interesting things about this particular study, they also look at three other arguments against such statistics was wrong. Number one, they actually say that there are two general types of PDE5 inhibitors. One is short-acting, the other one is long-acting. You would imagine that if you take the long-acting one, you're more predisposed to seeing skin cancer because that actually predisposes your skin to more risk, right? And they don't see that that difference.
So then what's...
So where's the argument,
yeah,
right?
Okay, right. I really struggle
so
with this
I
study.
Struggle with this. And then the other thing that they looked at was that if you get more prescription, right, of the drugs, then you are more likely to get cancer, right? And again, they don't see association like that.
So what we're seeing right now is this kind of tenuous link.
And I think it's very unfair because I get patients who turn up to the clinic with this local newspaper headline saying, what have you been doing to me? You know, it's like, this, and how do I check for skin cancer? I really think something reporting like this is quite irresponsible. So I'm quite interested to hear the general public. Do you think that, sometimes statistics like this are completely meaningless? Because if you just imagine that what you're saying is that someone who are more affluent can actually afford the blue pill. And when they afford the blue pill, they probably can afford a Rolex. And then whenever you look at statistics like that, you say that, okay, they probably have got more chance of getting cancer. And you will draw the link between if you wear Rolex watch, you're more having more chance of getting skin cancer. It's almost like drawing such random statistics together, which is completely meaningful. However, when it comes to taboo medication like this, it causes a lot of unease
and stress. I would be so stressed if I were taking this
for a long time.
Yeah,
and then because it like you describe it, it's not like, for example, high blood pressure medication.
It's not life saving, so to speak.
Exactly. So you would kind of started thinking that I shouldn't have done that, but I find causation, these sort of like linkages, in a way, quite sensationalized in a statistic. And then I'm quite interested to hear the general public, what do you think about, issues like this? Would it stop you from, approaching medication like this? Or would it actually laugh on it? Or would you be more enticed to actually look at more of the data to find out what it means? In fact, you look at it, you actually felt that the studies were quite difficult to understand.
I did. I mean, at least in terms of the links they were presenting, I definitely felt that way. But if I had just read the headline, I would certainly be very, very concerned. And so I think that's worth asking. Do statistics scare you off medication? That number to call is 03-771-09000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be right back. Good afternoon. This is Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, and it is our doctor in the house, Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist.
Here. Going back to our kind of like a original type of topics, which evolves around men's health and sexual health, I guess.
It's so old school.
Old school. Second, this was what we started off with,
yes,
right, 7 years ago.
It's nostalgia at
it
this
is,
point.
It is, absolutely. It's been 17 years. Some people think that, the blue pill was only kind of brought to the market about 5 years ago. Time flies, guys.
It does. Okay, before we go back to our focus on the blue pill, we had a question earlier about whether or not ibuprofen is safe for children.
Okay, this is the sort of the questions that people will get asked because they might look at statistics to say certain drugs like ibuprofen is associated with asthma and so on and so forth. And then, of course, those are the specific side effects that's related. That's completely different. Ibuprofen is safe for children. In fact, I prescribe it a lot for the children. However, there are certain children who may not be good enough, who may not be suitable to take those. For example, children who have got kidney failure, asthmatic, and then so ibuprofen is generally safe. However, these are not suitable for certain group of patients. Those are called contraindication. And this is not what we're talking about here. We're talking about an association, and that sort of linkages that people make whenever they talk about prolonged usage of such and such is linked to something else.
Well, on that note, I mean, okay, so going back to this exact story then, as mentioned, I found it confusing. I mean, I understood it, but that didn't mean that I saw the argument that they were making. So what, and you described earlier having patients coming in with this article and saying, what does this mean? So how do you actually explain that when you get to that point?
Okay. No, so it is quite difficult in order to explain that, because the headline news is that the men who fill at least one prescription of ED drugs face a 21% higher chance of malignant melanoma. That was the news.
Yes.
And then that was the news that they come out and say, I had more than one prescription and I am at risk of 21% more chance of malignant melanoma. So first thing first, I would actually calm the patient down and actually say, malignant melanoma, actually for us Asians, and then, you know, who is not fair skin, blonde hair, and then I keep going on about blonde eyes. Blonde hair, blue eyes, actually is not that common. So that's the first thing first. Because malignant melanoma is a different kind of like conditions that affect different group of people. And then they're more people are more susceptible if they are going under the sun with unprotected kind of like a skin.
Sunscreen.
That's right. Okay. So first thing you ask the patient, are you in that sort of group of people? It's like, you know, some of them say, yeah, I do play golf. And then, it's, you know, I am more susceptible in a sense of that. So this is how we kind of like eventually trying to do a risk assessment and trying to make them understand this is not serious.
Somebody who might be able to tell us about how to present stats on drug studies is actually our phone call, our person on the phone now, Gan. Good afternoon, Gan.
Hi, Gan.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yeah. So actually, I called in just to comment on you know, sometimes these newspapers and articles, they tend to
sensationalize.
Yeah, sensationalize these things because they don't really understand statistics, especially biostatistics.
Mm-hmm.
Especially whenever we look at these studies and the numbers, we need to know the difference between absolute reduction, absolute risk reduction, and what is called a relative risk reduction.
Right.
So, yeah, the numbers in absolute risk reduction would tell you absolutely or how much increase or decrease risk there is. So, mm-hmm. for example, this patient, before a patient who doesn't take the drug may have a 0.0001
yes.
Risk of having the drug, having that side effect. And if a patient after taking the drug may have, let's say, 0.002 increase in risk, so that the difference, which is 0.001%, is called an absolute risk reduction.
Okay, good point.
But if you look at the relative risk, it's actually 100% increase.
Right, so, indeed.
Yeah, when, yeah, and most papers, they will actually...
they sell the figure very differently.
Yeah, so they sell it as 100% increase in risk, but actually the risk itself is still very, very, very small.
Right, great point. I mean, Gan, are you in? Are you a statistician?
No, but I'm a specialist in pharmacotherapy.
Oh, pharmacotherapy. So how do we, I mean, obviously something like this will create some degree of scare. And then, you know, I mean, people would, even we calm patients down to actually say that, you know, malignant melanoma is not too common in Malaysia and that sort of thing. You know, how do we kind of present this to tell the patient that, look, this is exactly what it means? Because the headline says 21% higher risk of getting malignant melanoma.
I agree, actually. I have patients coming in sometimes asking these questions as well, you know, whether they are at risk. And usually what we do is, as per patient basis, we could explain. Those who are better educated, they could understand, especially those with a good math background, they could understand the statistics. But sometimes, I guess we just have to calm them down and let them know, you know, actually the risk isn't that great. I've seen 20, you know, 100 patients, and probably not even one of them actually had a side effect.
Yeah.
Yeah, and things like that. So sometimes it's by anecdotal experience that we could tell them. But yeah, it's a very gray area to fix, actually. That's what I feel.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah. Yeah,
thanks,
I'm obviously playing with numbers, really, isn't it?
That's exactly it. I mean, that was the point that I was trying to make earlier. You know, the whole notion of, well, how do you communicate numbers to people who are suddenly worried about heart attacks and cancer? Because it's a very emotional thing.
It is.
You know, I'm worried about my health and you're trying to tell me that, you know, it's only a 1 in 100 thing. Well, I could be that one.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, let me give you another example that will scare people a lot. I mean, in my line of work, vasectomy is something that I do all the time. And then, of course, men are scared enough not to come forward for vasectomy because they have no idea what's going on. I have men who actually are preparing to have vasectomy. And then, you know, before I actually inject the local anesthetic, say, hold on 1 minute. Say, you know, can I find out, what are you going to do with my testicle after you remove them? Right, okay. And that is a sort of, anxiety, state of anxiety that you get patients are in. And then whenever they read in an article saying that vasectomy increases your chance of getting prostate cancer by 25%, and then it's exactly what Gunn says. Let's say you get a group of people who are in control group, and then a group of people who are, the ones who have vasectomy. And then when you compare them over a 20-year period, you know, there is, let's say, not in, comparison, 1 in 10,000 men actually had detected, cancer. And then on the other hand, you had 2. And then so in 2 in 10,000 men who were followed up who's got this condition. And then you would say there's a 50% chance of you having this problem. But the thing is, it's all a numbers game and it doesn't mean a lot of things. And that sometimes can be quite confusing.
Well, I mean, for people listening, if you have a preferred way of how you'd like these risks explained to you, perhaps you can call in and enlighten us, because clearly it's something that everybody's struggling with. We struggle with understanding it. You struggle with explaining it to us. So if you... if you've got a preferred way of getting that explained, or if you've ever been frightened off medicine because of headlines like this, our phone lines are open. That number is 0377109000. You can also text 0162019000 or tweet at BFM Radio. Now, I want to bring in somebody who has previously been on this show and is a regular in general, Dr. Rajesh Singh, who earlier in the week said he is a firm believer in numbers. He loves statistics. He thinks
He comes up with all these diagrams, like one MDB diagrams and things like that. That's right. Yeah, you know. So which is quite kind of like a simplify things a little bit, right?
He says that numbers don't lie. To him, numbers help him kind of understand.
Well,
and help
numbers
him communicate.
Don't lie because in the statistical form and also in mathematical form, but the numbers create emotion. Like you earlier on, you said it's a very emotional thing. So a number that relate to your condition, let's say if your mother has got breast cancer, and certain number will induce some sort of emotion for you, and that is something that will cause a lot of bias. And I really think that is quite scary.
So how do you then, as a doctor, communicate the risks and side effects to your patients? I mean, even before they come in a panic, when you are at the point of prescription, how do you make sure that they are aware of what's happening, and also not to run scared in case they read something, you know?
This will nicely take us to, you know, exactly how do we communicate it? Because at the end of the day, this is like you said, is a non-life threatening medications. And then so later on, towards the second part of the show, we can actually talk about how safe is this medication, and also exactly what else is it used for. You know, that will give us some idea. So for me, you know, whenever a man who comes forward, we always talk numbers, just like, you know, Dr. Rajesh Singh's actually talk about numbers. It's actually say, okay, 5% of people may have hot flushes. 5% of people may have indigestions. And then also 2% of people may get headache. And these are the statistics that I put forward. And these are absolute numbers. So as you say, you know, if you read the drugs informations, you will get the same figures. And this is what the experience I have prescribing for the patients. Most reassuring thing that you have to give the patient is, if you encounter all these problems, then, you know, these are the numbers to call and these are the things to do. What will create a problem is long-term effect, you know, because there are some anecdotal studies to actually say that certain men may develop infertility, for example, using this for a long time. Certain men may develop, visual slight
loss affected. Of vision.
Yeah, that's right, that sort of thing. And a lot of time, all these are the long-term statistics that it's remain unknown. So all the figures are so small, like one like Gunn described it earlier on, that we're talking about 0.001%. And then so I usually will just say that if you feel like these are something that you may affect you, perhaps you may take more precaution. Let's say, for example, the vasectomy. I can see that they are emotionally charged when they worry about the link between prostate cancer and vasectomy. I will give them assurance that this statistics may mean a lot to you. However, I'm going to take your thing seriously. I'm going to get your concern seriously, because otherwise I'm going to brush it off. They're just going to go to see another doctor until they get this. Because sometimes, like you said, it's quite emotional. So what I do is assure them that I will continuously monitor you to ensure that you don't fall into that statistics.
These are medicines, that we think of as relatively safe.
Yes.
But when you talk about long-term, I think there is where the big, emotional cave opens up, because then you think, well, do we know everything there is to know about these drugs?
That's right.
So how do you reassure people when they come to you with that, and say like, well, how do you know? Maybe 20 years from now, we'll discover something.
That's right. Well, it is difficult because, like we early on said, this drug was introduced in 1998. We're looking at 17 years of this medication. Most scientists will say to you after this medication has been in the market, it's safe enough to be considered as a drug that is commonly used. And it's safe enough to even go generic in many, many countries. However, you still have to address the fear people have, because why did that headline strike your attention is because you have some emotional fear towards that particular condition.
At what point do we need to reassess? At what point should we legitimately raise the alarm bells, and not just flag up funny statistics? At what point do we have to say, okay, we might need to reassess our views on this? And when people come in, you go, yeah, okay, let's talk about that.
I mean, in fact, there are lots and lots of safety nets that pharmaceutical industry. Like, say, for example, there are lots and lots of ways that alarm bells can be rung, intermittently. For example, there's a new cancer drug that comes out, and then, people are using this new cancer drugs, and then the doctors can intermittently report serious adverse event. Let's say the drug's been approved 5 years down the line, and then the doctors begin to see more and more people get heart attack from taking these cancer drugs, for example. And then when we report these serious adverse event, they get processed, and then they will actually initiate the safety net for people to analyze to see whether globally this is one-off or this is happening everywhere. And that is when the actual medications being taken into scrutiny more seriously. And I really think that we have that sort of fail-safe in our system.
How up-to-date do doctors keep on the latest statistics and studies? So when somebody comes in and says, hey, 21%, that's the additional amount of risk that you've exposed me to, how likely is it to potentially catch you unaware?
In fact, it caught me unaware. And this morning when I was having breakfast with a fellow urologist, I mentioned that there is a link. And then the first thing he looked at me and said, rubbish. And I was like, no, seriously, this appeared on the local newspaper. And this is when I get people coming forward to see me. It's very difficult. I mean, we have thousands and thousands and thousands of data coming out all the time. And something like this could potentially be a sub-analysis of a big data. I mean, there are 25,000 people. And then they may link something like, using certain car brand with, the risk of prostate cancer, for example. And that will scare people. And then so these are the sub-analysis. So it depends on what question you want answering. And then it depends on how sensationalized you want things done.
I'm speaking today with Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist and our doctor in the house. And we've been discussing a supposed association between erectile dysfunction and melanoma, but we've also been talking about how best to present information to patients. I mean, especially when it comes to medication, how do you want risks to be explained to you? Do statistics help? If you have got any questions, any opinions, any stories to share, that phone line to call is 03-77-109-000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We will be back after the market update. You are listening to BFM 89.9. Hello, you are still listening to Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and it is our doctor in the house, Dr. George Lee, consulting urologist in the studio with me. We've spent some time discussing safety
statistics.
But looking specifically at ED medication then, you know, let's hunker down and look at, you know, the source of the whole thing.
What's your opinion on this, Lynn? I mean, so what's your opinion on medication like this? Do you know, some people feel very strongly about it. Some people think that this will save marriages. Some people think this is a complete waste of money. Some people think this is the reflections of capitalism. And some people think this is deterioration of moral standards. What's your view on these sort of medications?
I think it can be all those things.
Lynn, you are being a politician. You're not answering the question.
It is my honest answer. I feel that it depends from patient to patient. I think that if you are the kind of person for whom you know, your sexual life is a very, very, very important thing, and it's a huge part of who you are, then of course, in some cases, I would even go so far as to say, sure, it's life-saving, because it helps to restore you to, you know, who you feel yourself to be.
The reason why I'm asking you is because, you know, you always strike me as a bit of a feminist, right? Okay? We have numerous discussions about, you know, how men's compromise, and you kind of shoot me down straight away. So why do you think, for something like this, do you think it's a very chauvinistic kind of medication?
I don't think it's chauvinistic. That's the thing. I mean, okay.
Well, so, this is quite good, because
the thing about feminism is that it allows everybody the right to live their life however they want to.
Okay.
And I think that if you're
everybody,
the kind
including
of,
men.
Exactly. Nice. Absolutely. And I think if you're the kind of person who chooses this, who believes that it really is important to you, then by all means, spend your money and, you know, have yourself and feel good.
Okay.
Live life the way you want to.
I agree.
So that's why
why do you think in these days and age there's still this taboo and judgment on people who use medication like this?
I think because it's not necessary. I mean, it's not viewed as necessary in the sense of it
because there are more real diseases.
Sure. I mean, it's not just there are more real diseases, but it's kind of like, well, if you're going to be putting something into your body, you know, it should be for your health and not necessarily for quote unquote fun, even though, you know, that might not be how
it's
viewed.
Some people look at sexual health as quote unquote fun.
Exactly.
Some people look at sexual health as quote unquote necessity.
Necessity, psychological importance.
That's right.
You know,
all these
different things.
All these different things, and then it's a relationship drugs. And I think from the very beginning, you know, 1998 when this drug was discovered, it's always had that cloud of judgment around it.
Do you find that to still be the case?
Absolutely.
I mean, really?
Absolutely. You know, because you imagine, you know, in 1998, I remember I was a trainee, and in the UK, they have this talk show called Richard and Judy, and it's like in the morning, like morning chat shows and things like that.
Really are old school today.
Very old school. And suddenly, Richard said, I want to try this, and then, you know, and then so everybody begin to have these kind of like moral judgment to say, this is wrong, this is pushing the envelope, this is the slope of a moral deteriorations. And I think this medication see us through a lot of our inner struggle with how we look at sexual health and how we look at our own moral issues when it comes to society and also sex education. I really think that is kind of see us maturing into a society like that. Of course, we still have that conservativeness and we still have that liberalism.
I think in some ways, studies like this might worsen that problem, though.
Absolutely, because the whole question about this sort of like statistics is questioning the safety. It actually say, okay, right, we respect your liberalism, but it is not safe. And this is what I have told you from the beginning, that shouldn't have kind of like opened this Pandora's box into something like this. And then that's the reason why people come up with regrets to say, look, you know, I was convinced into doing this for the relationship, but now I am end up with bigger problems, which is exactly how this is. And therefore, you know, looking at the safety, I mean, initially the whole safety scared was like that when the blue pill initially came out.
Heart attacks,
you know, sudden death, you know, Bruce Lee kind of like a end up with Bruce Lee's kind of like a, you know, sudden death and that sort of things. And then, so the scares was around that. And then this is the most scrutinized medication in the history of medicine to see whether it's safe or not. And it's after how many, you know, millions of tablets being consumed, it is still equally scrutinized these days.
So there's stigma attached to coming up and asking for it. I mean, in the first place, confessing you have a problem.
Okay, yeah, exactly. Then, yeah. You know, well, because it is a whole ego, you know, society that, you know, the whole epiphany of the symbolism of your strength, your maleness, your manhood suddenly being compromised and suddenly come forward to say, I have a problem, is the first step that is not quite a norm in a society, especially in Asia.
Correct. So there's already one part to it. And then I think the second part is, do you find that patients still think of it? I mean, never mind what I think. I don't need it.
But when
people come up to you and say, okay, they've done the difficult first thing and said, I need it. And then obviously the follow-up to that is, do they ever feel
guilty?
Guilt, you know, over it being like a lifestyle choice as opposed to...
Of course.
Really? I find that fascinating.
So the first thing they do is that they own up to it. And then they say, okay, right, I need to dish out some cash to buy something like this. And next thing is to say, do I dare enough to pop into my mouth? And then do I want to have the compliance to carry on taking it? Am I doing this for myself or am I doing this for relationship? And then, you know, is this something wrong? Is this morally, insecure? And that sort of struggles, they go through that. And that's why compliance for medications per se in this sort of lifestyle is a real issue, because, you know, you get initially the treatment-seeking behavior and then subsequently the compliance of the treatment always is a struggle. And it's fascinating to see that. And it's not your own struggle to understand whether you need the treatment or not. It's a struggle how other people view you is an interesting part as well.
How frequently do people listen to the side effects and then say, I don't want this?
The interesting thing is that when they listen to side effects, I'm not 100% sure how much of that is being absorbed. So inside, I think when you take home that pill, and actually in your head, you're struggling with, should I take it, should I not? And then I think those statistics, of course, come into play to say 5%, 10%, 5% of headache and that sort of thing. And it seems so mild. But even though it seems so mild, to actually pop the pill, there's a lot of judgment. There's a lot of moral judgment. There's a lot of internal struggle to see whether they want to do that or not. And I think that's quite interesting. And eventually, once they do that, would that gratification in that relationship carries on or not? That's another kind of interesting issue that many people are studying to look at that treatment-seeking behavior.
How often do you find people come in to discuss this as a couple as opposed to...
Nearly none, you know, because...
Do you think it would be better?
Well, it will be completely better because everything will be open in the open. We have a situation where 70% of our patients will beat around the bush and actually say, I'm doing this for my friend. And then another 20% who actually will own up and say, okay, right, I'm doing it for me, but my wife shouldn't know about it. And then 10% will come in as a couple and openly say, you know, by the way, this has been going on so and so, and is it, by the way, can I find out also whether I can check up why I have got this problem? Do I have a blockage of my heart arteries or anything like that? So it is quite sad. And it's 17 years down the line, I mean, it's because that's the blue pills kind of era sees me through my career, and in that career I don't think it changed much. But interesting thing is that, you know, when we get the humor side of things and people say, well, how else is this pill used for? I would say, well, it's, when RAF, the Royal Air Force, in the UK, they actually had kind of like a audit, and they realized that £5,000 worth of the blue pill disappeared from their shelf. And then the big questions people asked was, what were the blue pills doing in the RAF? And it's actually used for altitude sickness.
Oh, there you go.
There you go. So, and also, you know, you get patients who kind of say, oh, all right, then I might guess I'll just take it for altitude sickness. And then other things that may be interesting that people don't know about, that actually it's a condition called pulmonary hypertension that is being used for, you know, the medication is used for that. And then, of course, you get wacky kind of way of using this. And some people put it in the flower pot in order to make sure that the flower stays alive for a longer period of time. Can you imagine? That's a very expensive way to keep your flowers going.
Well, that's what people use aspirin for as
exactly.
well.
Exactly, and Panadol as yeah. well. So why not to use the blue pills as well?
Well, it's expensive.
It is expensive.
We come back to the Viagra lifestyle. Now we know part of it is going to the beach and also keeping your flowers alive.
Running. So, I mean, if you Google, how these drugs used, and then you see that this is era of the last 17 years of how attitude change and so on and so forth. Of course, we made a lot of changes in the last 17 years, but there's still a lot of conservative taboo. And you're right, because it might fit somebody but may not be so suitable for others.
So with all that said then, with your career being the era of the little blue pill, what message would you like to leave us with for people who might still, be listening to the tail end of this show and then after this go out and read the article and go, oh my goodness, now I need to be worried? What would you say to the people who are worried about this link?
Well, I think it's not just particularly for the blue pill. I really think that the next time when you see a health statement coming out like that saying, X percentage of people taking any form of therapy will be linked to certain increase of medical conditions, things like that. First thing, actually look into the details, because the devil's really in the details. When you realize that when numbers actually don't really mean that much, then this is a piece of information that you really don't need. And so it is a sensationalized way of selling a piece of data, but that data may not necessarily apply for you. If you want to be cautious, you can always do that. Then you can work out the pros and cons, because this is part of the choice of being having an informed consent.
Thank you very much, Dr.
Pleasure.
George. I've been speaking with Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist and doctor in the house. We have been going old school today, discussing erectile dysfunction. It's just like 5 years ago. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.